Is that better? I think we can all hear. Very good. Thank you very much for inviting me, Rani, and I'll get to you later. No, thank you. Today I'd like to speak about the issue of discernment. And we could perhaps explore the issue of discernment from many different perspectives. One aspect could be organisational discernment, is how organisations attend to the corporate development or attend to the corporate soul of an organisation. The other one, which we're going to look at today, is individual discernment. How do we perhaps pay attention to the deep truth that emerges within us as a person and have the courage to follow that? And while communal and individual discernment share many common factors, today I'm only going to talk about individual discernment. And in offering this approach to discernment, I recognise that there are many different ways within the Christian tradition to practice and articulate discernment. So I'm just inviting you to say this is one window into looking at that approach. And I appreciate each of us needs to find our own way of discernment. When we discern, I'm suggesting we attend to and engage with that profound mystery that sometimes we call God. To discern is to perhaps to engage in a deeply human process. It's a bit like saying discernment is as easy and as difficult as breathing. And how we describe the process of discernment depends upon our particular religious and philosophical traditions about how we interpret life. And I assume that each of you in your own way, you wouldn't be sitting here unless you've been able to discern your own life and pay attention to it. And I guess we often do it very informally and very automatically. And I guess it's like saying this is simply just one way of trying to name a process that you're already doing. I'm suggesting that discernment is mainly an ordinary day-to-day process. It's something that happens in the smallest things of our life. Yet there are times of critical times of transition in our life when in such liminal spaces, whether we like them or not, discernment is a particularly intense moment. And if you've ever been dragged through such a period of time in your life, if you haven't experienced struggle, you haven't been in discernment. So one such example we can talk about in discernment is we look at Mark's account of Jesus struggling in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, we could say here is an experience of discernment in the real. Because here we say it's recorded that Jesus became deeply disturbed and troubled, so he must have been discerning. He felt so overwhelmed that he was filled with sorrow to the point of death. So if sometimes you've been in a process of discernment and you haven't feel like throwing up your guts, you're not actually in a process of discernment. Here we know that when we pay attention to the psychological movements within Jesus as a person, as Mark records it, Jesus was sifted bare. Jesus struggled to discern what direction he should take. Does he continue to go ahead and proclaim the coming of the kingdom in the opposition of religious and political authorities, or because there are no streetlights in the Garden of Gethsemane, can he slip away in the middle of the night, go back to sleepy Nazareth, and quietly reopen his carpentry business? So there's a sense in which we perhaps see that, you know, he did have a way out if he wanted it, and perhaps his process of discerning gave him the courage to stay. But what's interesting is that he didn't stop being human. It was a process that got deeply sifted through him. What I'd like to do now is to perhaps tell you a story about a discernment in ordinary life. Some years ago, I went through a gardening phase. I don't know if you go through phases, but I went through a gardening phase. And where I was living at that stage, there was a little bit of ground at the back of my house. So I thought, I'll pull up the weeds and prepare the ground. And then I went to that particular sacred site called Bunnings, and to the temple of all things, and bought a little punnet of tomato plants. And I brought them back, and as I was doing that, I thought, if I'm going to be discerning about things, I need to be discerning while I plant tomatoes. And so I just spent time digging the soil up and putting the plants in. And if you've ever done any gardening, as you remove them from the punnet and put them into the ground, you have to do it very simply. And, you know, make sure it's not too deep and not too shallow. And I was patting them in. And as I was doing that, I was just trying to notice my experience. And as I was doing it, and all the flies around and everything else that was around, as I noticed, I put in one little tomato plant, and as I put it in, it just went like that. Okay, just like that. And then I put in the rest of them. It sounds like you put in a few tomato plants in your life, but it sounds that. And so what was interesting, as I was planting these things, what I noticed about discernment is to pay attention. And more importantly, to pay attention to the simplest things. And so as I was paying attention, I noticed it's a little bit like if something just tugs your collar, just like that. It's not as though an angel appeared to me, but just something tugged me. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just see what happens. And then, because meditation is part of my daily practice, the next day I was sort of trying to pay attention to what was happening. And sometimes distractions are to be avoided in prayer. Sometimes they're to be paid attention to. And so I thought, this little tomato plant kept coming back to me. And so I thought, oh, I just need to pay attention. And I was just aware of revisiting the actual sensory experience of planting that tomato. And so sometimes when I notice something, what I need to do is to engage with it. And to engage with it, for me, is not so much to intellectually dissect something, but perhaps a way to amplify the experience and enter it more deeply. So sometimes for myself, I might just draw it. You know, I'm not entering an art competition, I just draw it. Or sometimes what I might do for myself, as on this occasion over a period of time, I began to let myself become the tomato plant. So I wasn't having a delusional episode. I just begin to write down, I'm the tomato plant inside you, Stephen. And I want to talk to you. So there's a sense in which on a piece of paper in dialogue, I put T for tomato and ST for my name. And just on the paper, just begin to talk backwards and forwards to this tomato plant. For me, the whole point is not so much to analyse the experience, but to engage it. And so over a period of time, as I began over a few days and weeks, as I stayed with it in my meditation of a morning, I became aware that, in one sense, what I was becoming aware of was the frailty of that plant. And so as I stayed with that, I began to then write, I'm the frailty inside you, Stephen. And I began to do that. And over a period of time, as I stayed with that event, I became aware that that what I first saw in that little tomato plant was actually really a mirror of my own human vulnerability as a person. And as I stayed with that experience over time, I began to find that I wasn't not so much free from my human frailty, but that I could find a freedom within it. It's a bit like saying when we look at that post-resurrection narrative when Jesus met his disciples, the way that the authors present Jesus is that he met them in a post-resurrection phase. He met them with the holes in his hands and his feet. So perhaps we can see that resurrection is not so much a freedom from our wounds, it's learning to come to a place of freedom within our woundedness. So in coming back to my simple little tomato story, I was aware that in just simply staying with that experience over a period of time, I became aware, it moved from just noticing that plant to actually becoming more effectively self-present to my own human vulnerability as a person. And as I stayed with that experience, I came to a place of freedom within myself. And what was interesting after that is that I began to find that in days or weeks later, I could suddenly find myself in situations where I would normally feel anxious about something. I didn't stop feel anxious, but I was aware somehow it was okay to be anxious in that setting. And that sense was my freedom. In one sense, it's a very simple incident, but I think if you just look at that very simple incident of how this tomato plant brought me to a deeper level of conversion, discernment is about staying paying attention to the unfolding movements within one's life. And I guess what I'd like to do now is to use that story as a way to perhaps reflect more deeply on the process of conversion. I'd like to suggest to you that the process of discernment is embedded within the concreteness of our daily life. That is, within the whatness of our life. It doesn't happen anywhere else. It happens in the whatness of our life. As one author says, God comes to us disguised as our life. Here in this concrete human experience that makes up the fabric of our life, it's in this context that we encounter this profound mystery we sometimes God. So the expression was, God comes to us disguised as our life. To paraphrase an early Christian writer, Clement of Alexandria, he said, and appreciate this is a paraphrase of his quite exclusive patriarchal framework, so I've just tried to rework a little bit in as much as one can. He said, if we come to know ourselves, we come to know God. And knowing God will be made like God. So I guess what he's saying is that our human experience is the context in which we most deeply meet God. And what I'm trying to suggest today is what I want to outline further today is that this concrete human experience can be conceived of as taking place within four arenas, sometimes called the life frame. I know for myself, when I'm trying to pay attention to my life, it's easy for me to only look at a part of my life, whereas perhaps real discernment is to notice all of my reality, not just a small sliver of it. And so I'm trying to suggest that life perhaps is a four-dimensional reality, not just one dimension. I'm not sure if you can see that, but I guess what I'd like to do is to introduce you some of you may have heard this before, but it's a way of just trying to, how do I be present to all of my life rather than just a part of it? What I'd like to do is to start with the one down the bottom called the individual, or sometimes we call the intrapersonal. This is noticing the reality of my life from the skin in. It's, you might say, the smallest one. So this covers my feelings, it covers my thoughts, it covers that sort of endless traffic of thought that goes through our mind. It covers our personal history, our inner tapes. It recalls all our family of origin scripts. It's how I relate to the fleshiness of my human body, my sexuality and orientation as a person. So this is the area, the individual or intrapersonal, where we are present to what happens within our inner life. And for us, if you're more attracted to introversion rather than extroversion, is more my personality, this is the area that perhaps I'm more at home with in terms of paying attention to the interior movements inside of myself and appreciate both the gift and the limitation of that. The second area is what we call the interpersonal. This is what happens in the informal relationships of our life. This is about the casual meetings we have with people. It's a bit like saying the informal conversations we had before we gathered to meet in worship today. The third area is what we call the social or structural. And particularly for us in Western society, we're involved in a multitude of network relationships. So one way to talk about roles, role theory suggests, it's a particular way in a certain set of relationships that I feel, think, and act. And so if you look at your own life as a member of this congregation or as a parent or as a partner, you're aware that in each of those different roles, there are prescribed ways to feel, think, and act. And in our culture, you might say, we are part of a multitude of network of relationships of culture and so on. So it's a bit like saying, you know, like when you may have first joined this community, when it was recently or some time ago, you would be aware that whether you had been in another Christian community or not before you came to this one, you noticed after a while this group has a particular way of feeling, thinking, and acting together. It doesn't mean you all got to think the same way, but there'd be certain shared values about how you feel, think, and value that shape how you perhaps are together as a community. I think we're most conscious of this, you might say, when we first go to a new workplace or a new social setting. So if you go to a new workplace, you're suddenly aware that somehow we do things differently here, or this is how we do business. Like, I remember once speaking to somebody who was a school teacher, and she was saying to me, even though she'd been a teacher for many years, when she shifted schools and went to a new place, she's aware it was still an educational facility, but she's aware that somehow the culture of this place was slightly different. And so being appreciative of the gift of the power and the weakness of cultural frameworks is a critical part of taking notice of the reality. And the fourth way, and I appreciate I'll explain this a bit more as we go along, is environmental. It's called the nature or the created world. And so there's a sense in which you might say the fact that we're in this hall, we set out the chairs in this shape, all these sorts of things shape the environment. And so in one sense, we can talk about our experience of reality through the nature. So a bit like saying, if we were meeting outside or eating here, it'd be still the same group of people, but the natural context we image would shape how we do our worship together. Now, I appreciate I've data dropped a lot of information there, and I'll unpack this a bit further in a moment. But while these four areas can be conceived as separate domains, there's a connection flows between them that can be generally described as simultaneity. Because once grace enters one part of our arena, our life, it generally flows through to another. It may take time, however, to show itself in the life of a person. Waiting for the emergence of grace is necessary here. So if I just go back to this for a moment, and if I bring out my little friend, the tomato plant, when you look at this experience, you might say, and I'm trying to pay attention to my reality, I was in the actual physical environment. So if I'm using this life frame as a way to pay attention to my experience, first of all, the environmental, I was in my backyard planting. So the environment I was in was very critical. The structural framework it wasn't so strong, but I was in a house owned by the organisation I'm part of. The interpersonal was not present because I was there by myself, but the individual was because I was trying to pay attention to what was happening within me as a person. And so we find that as I work more with that, what was interesting as I became more aware of the frailty of the tomato plant, which in one sense was a mirror image of my own, what was interesting as I came to a place of freedom in what we call the individual arena, I was aware that in the structural arena, when I was in a particular work situation, somehow I felt freer. So it's a bit like saying we may come to a place of freedom through one domain, but it may start spot fires of freedom in other parts of our life. While human experience can be entered through one of our doorways, the processing of this experience occurs at deeper and deeper levels. And what I'd like to do now is to perhaps talk about that a little bit more deeply and to introduce you to this concept. So it's a bit like saying, how do we discern things? How do we pay attention? And what are some of the different levels of noticing that are integral to how we discern things? The first level of noticing, we might call, is the objective, conceptual, or interpretive level. And this is where most of us live most of our lives. This level holds our common perceptions and values. It's a level where thoughts, intuitions, desires and dreams are put into words and shared as concepts or interpretations. Such things as laws, mores, embedded values and interpretive events occur in this arena. All the arenas could provide an example. For example, in the interpersonal doorway, a conceptual or interpret example might be that you may identify with a particular personality type. You may find I'm a particular Enneagram type or something like that. Through the interpersonal doorway, you may be aware that you had a private conversation with somebody just before this gathering began. Through the structural doorway, an example could be that the board passed a resolution today that will affect the overall productivity of our organisation. So if I understand here tomorrow night, a group of people are meeting as the elders group. So I assume in one sense that's an organisational framework or the social structural framework. And through the environmental doorway could be an example of the national park systems are in danger from fire created by lightning. So it's a bit like saying, I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that when you're trying to discern something, I invite you to pay attention to all of it, not part of it. So if you are dealing with, say, a critical life incident as a person, one way to sort of do is to look at those four different quadrants and think, how can I notice my reality in this particular event at the moment? So for my little tomato plant thing, I was aware that two of those domains were a lot stronger. One was the experience of what was surfacing me as a person, and the other one was the environmental one, is my experience of being in this environment. Now, it would be so easy for me to only just pay attention to my individual experience, where what was important is to get a broader picture. The broader picture was to notice the physical environment in which I was living. The second level, and I'll talk more about this, is what we call the reflexive level. That includes those events, situations, and moments that break the conscious flow and make us stop, look, and listen. So if I go back to my simple experience of the tomato plant, I put in a lot of tomato plants that day, but one of them caught my attention. So this experience of reflectiveness is that experience in this moment of this having caught my attention. Another way to talk about reflexiveness is if you sort of go for an annual checkup to the doctor, and you're sitting there, one of the tests that person may do is the person will sit you there, ask you to cross your leg, and will just tap you there just below the knee. And you notice when you get tapped there below the knee, there will be this automatic reflex that you'll make. So I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that very simple reflexive moment is what we're looking at here. You might see it, say, if you are reading a piece of scripture or if you're familiar with the Lectio Divina. You may be aware that you're reading a text. You may have read that text hundreds of times in your life, but as you're reading that text, a particular word just stands out to you at the moment. It may draw your attention or it may resist your attention, but you notice something just notes your attention. And so I'm just trying to suggest that this reflexive noticing is not waiting for an angel to tap you on the shoulder. It's this very simple process of noticing the subtlety of what's happening. All analogies limp, but it's a bit like if you watch on a military aircraft carrier, when a plane comes into land, there is this arrestor wire that hooks the plane as it comes in. Now, hopefully we don't all get suddenly jolted in life like that arrestor wire, but this reflexiveness is to notice this experience. Another example could be like if you ever go fishing, you've got your line in the water, and you just sometimes know there's just a little tug, very simple. And that reflexive notice gives you the hint, now's the time to pull that fish. So I guess what I'm inviting you to say, there's a lot of reflexive moments in life, it's just that we have to pay attention to them. And as you're listening to what I'm saying to you, I invite you to think like, When was the last time that you had a reflexive experience? It could be very simple. It's simply when something took your attention. It can be very simple. It's very subtle. It may be something that attracts your attention. And what we notice, it is a subjective in the body experience. So, for instance, all of us could go and stand in a line on the beach down by the water, watch the sunset. We're all trying to pay attention. We're all watching the sunset. We all see the same sunset. All of our feet are in the water feeling wet. But as we stay with that experience, assumably each of us would have our own in the body, immediate, subjective, reflexive experience. All of us would be aware that somehow that experience would tug at us. And so we're all looking the same thing. But what's uniquely different is the subjectivity of this reflexiveness. It's not rocket science. It's very simple. All I'm just inviting you to say, look, this happens all the time. Just pay attention. So this reflexiveness can be very simple. I'm not saying it's like a bomb going off. It's subtle. It's as subtle as when you're going fishing and something tugs. You can, if you're not paying attention, you can miss the moment. So it's a bit like my experience of my little tomato plant. If I didn't pay attention, I would have missed that moment. There are all sorts of types of reflexive experiences that come to us. It could be the shock of hearing the news of a death of a close friend. It could be seen through the interpersonal doorway. Sometimes a vivid dream that stays with one is an interpersonal example of this reflexiveness. Just to give you some, I recall some years ago I was involved with trying to establish a master's program at Notre Dame University in spiritual direction. And we had a couple of months, we had 12 people enrolled to go, and we only had a month or so before the program was due to start. And an organization that had funded 3 people to attend this ran into funding difficulties and could no longer fund people, so we ended up having 9 people enrolled rather than 12, and we needed 10 people to break even. So I remember one night I was trying to struggle what to do, to discern what to do, and I had a dream, and in the dream there was this, I was the coach captain of this small little minibus of people, and all the people were on board. And I was the coach captain, and we were getting ready to go to this long trip to the centre of Australia to visit Ayers Rock. And I got out of the little minibus in my dream, and then I walked around and kicked all the tyres as I went around. And as I went around the back of the bus, there was no spare tyre. So in the dream, I went back and told everybody who'd bought their ticket and paid for the trip to go to the centre of Australia that they had to get off because we didn't have a spare tyre. So I guess what I'm saying is that dream was a very powerful dream because it awoke for me that I needed to decide to not go ahead with that project, of which I didn't. And so there's a sense in which that type of reflexive experience can come to us suddenly like that in a dream. Other reflexive experiences can happen like in different ways, and appreciate no one has a monopoly on reflexive experiences. To give you an example, once I worked in an inner city church just down from the Harbour Bridge, and there were 12 priests on the staff. And I was involved in being the celebrant for during the day we'd have 6 or 7 liturgies each day. And it was late morning and I was due to be the celebrant of the midday liturgy. And I was just sitting in the church beforehand doing my meditation. And while I was doing that, a fairly disheveled fellow came in and approached me and asked me for some money. And I took one look at him and told him to get lost because we'd had a number of people who'd been using very long steel cones to pull money out of the poor box, and I didn't think anything more about it. And then the liturgy took place, and then at communion time, as I was handing out communion to people, I was trying to pay attention to what was going on, and suddenly this man, who I'd told to take a different direction, certainly turned up for communion. And then I was sitting, so after communion in our ritual, liturgy, we just sometimes sit and have a time of reflection. And I was sitting there just trying to stay present to what was happening. And this small voice inside and said to me, "You'll give him my body without thinking. Why won't you give him something of lesser importance?" So that was quite a profound reflexive moment for me. And I went to look for him later but couldn't find him. But I suppose as I was trying to stay present to just noticing this man, paying attention to him, and then listening to this reflexive experience inside of me, it spoke to me quite powerfully. So I suppose I'm just trying to think, like, reflexive experiences can happen as simply as the tug of a tomato plant, as I had, or they can be more powerful experiences like the dream that I had about needing to tell the people that we weren't going on the bus tour to the centre of Australia, or they can sometimes come in a form of what we call an interior auditory experience, where suddenly something, a sense of inner knowing, just suddenly comes to us. These reflexive moments can happen in four arenas at any time of the day and night, and in a sense, they have the power to make one sense pause and consider its meaning. It'd be interesting to interview Jesus, who's not here to defend himself, if we went to that Garden of Gethsemane after he'd spoken to his disciples three times and they were falling asleep. I wonder what was his reflexive experience that helped him to pay attention to what he needed to do about whether he reopened his carpentry shop or whether he stayed there and faced the music. We don't know. But I guess it's like saying after he came back from the fact that three times people didn't pay attention to what he was saying and fell asleep, I wonder whether it had been out of that moment of despair that a sense of freedom came to him. So I guess what we're sort of saying, part of this discernment process is not only paying attention to actually what's going on around us, but it's also paying attention to the subjective movement that happens within us, that happens simply. Because I guess what we're trying to say is the heart of reflexivity is the spiritual noticing of that in the body immediate subjective experience. It's a bit like if we look at Luther's experience in the Tower, he talked about a scripture alone, sola scripta, and the sense in which you might say, was that his reflexive experience that helped shape his life? So I guess we're sort of saying at this stage of reflexivity, rather than staying with the whatness of what actually happened, we need to stay with the howness of our experience, how we actually feel. In other words, we need to be present to this affective interior sense of ourself as self. And it's about becoming affectively self-present to oneself. So I guess I'm trying to suggest that this noticing of one's reflexivity, it's not scratch lotto. It's not one-stop shopping. There's a sense in which often it can be the introduction to a very agonising, long-term, scratchy and messy process as it has its way with us. So the sense is, it's like paying attention to this inner movement. After we stay with this experience for a while, we observe at some time, we move down to encounter the deepest level of our being, which we describe as non-thematic. It's the level of being in existence. It cannot be put into words. It undergirds all our human experience and is the source of the contact with that mystery we sometimes call God. It's the experience of reality beyond words, and such examples would include experiences of deep awe, profound stillness, and the discovery of peace in places of deep vulnerability. So I suppose what I'm saying, as we find that we struggle with these experiences, or more likely they struggle with us, as we stay with the ebb and flow of that movement, we usually find that we are brought to a place of stillness. Sometimes we find we are brought to a place of surrender, a surrender that we did not choose. Because often when we think we're surrendering, it's a covert form of control. I recall, when I was on a 30-day retreat a couple of years ago, the 30-day Ignatian retreat, as you may know, basically over a four-week period, invites you to reflect on the scripture of the life of Jesus. And I was aware of, I was reflecting on Jesus' death, and in the Ignatian methodology, as you may know, part of what is to take the scripture text, imagine the scene, place yourself in it, and allow yourself to dialogue with the people who were there. And I was aware I was sitting on a deep circular abyss or a cavern like that. I was sitting there with my legs over the edge, and Jesus was sitting next to me, and he looked really knocked around. And you could see that this man was just sitting there, close to death. And I don't know if you've ever been close to death yourself, but I've been once or twice in my life. There's a point. There's this slow point between when you let go into death or whether you stay in life. Anyway, I was sitting next to him, and I was aware as I sat next to him, there's a sense in which, how do I let myself surrender into God? And while I had a sense of my desire to do that, I felt a profound resistance to do so. It's like I had my own starch inside myself. But what was profound about the experience, and which was my reflexive experience that brought me to a place of deep stillness, as he sat next to me, he simply said to me, "Can you simply put your arm through mine and help me lean forward?" Because if you're sitting on the edge of abyss and you need to let yourself fall into the abyss of death, to do so, you have to let go. And he said, "Just help me move forward." And as I put my arm through his and I helped him lean forward to fall into the abyss, I fell with him. And in that falling, I came to a place of a deeper freedom in myself. And so what's interesting, in that moment of abyss, I found that it was his vulnerability, you might say, that saved me. So I suppose what I'm trying to say, when you look at your own journey in life, we're looking at these three movements. There is a movement of just noticing what's happening in my life. In other words, this sensory awareness. The second level, this reflexive level, is learning to just pay attention to what subjectively surfaces within me, what gets prompted within me as a person. It's a bit like saying, hopefully all of us sitting here, the blood's running through our veins. But the reflexive experience is that experience of like, if I put my fingers just about there, I'm aware if I stop and be still, I can start to feel the movement of the pulse inside of myself. So in one sense, reflexivity is that human capacity or deeply spiritual capacity just to be present to what's pulsating within our life. And as we stay present to that pulsating thing and have the courage to do so, we find that often it can bring us to a place of deep personal and liberating freedom. And as I go back to the experience of Jesus being crucified and fronting up to meet his disciples afterwards, it's a bit like saying, the resurrection is, when we experience resurrection, it's not that we're free from our wounds, but we come to a place of freedom within our wounds. So just to wind up, I guess what I'd like to do is a simple shorthand way of talking about this process is to suggest that discernment is a process of what we call double noticing. The first level of noticing is to pay attention to the sensory content of what we see, smell, touch, taste, and hear. It's as simple as that. It's not rocket science. It's simply about paying attention. In some contemporary language, it talks about mindfulness. It's just noticing your experience. Not analysing, just noticing. It's a bit like saying, the last time you had a shower, when did you actually feel wet in the water? If that makes sense. Like, when you had something to eat, when did you actually taste the food? So this level, what I call sensory contemplation, is a way of just experiencing the immediacy of the nowness of the present moment. The second level is to engage with the particular reflexive experience that emerges from within us. This is that subjective, in-the-body, affective experience that spontaneously comes to our awareness. Then staying with this experience, we encounter and are transformed by the profound mystery we sometimes call God. We sometimes find that if people are dealing with post-traumatic shock or things like that, or disassociation, part of what happens is these two places get split off, because what we're needing to do is to reconnect to the unlived and unexplored parts of our life. So I'm sensing that discernment is a simple process. It's double noticing. There's two movements. One is simply notice what's happening. And the second level is to engage the reflexivity that's spontaneously available to us if we pay attention. And if we stay with it and let it sift us at times, it will be transformed by that profound mystery we sometimes call God. And as that Paula Darcy said, I said earlier, she said, God comes to us disguised as our life. You don't have to leave your life to find God. What's interesting is that if we look at, say, the early Greek philosopher Aristotle, and after him Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, they used an interesting description. They said the human person is what he called a contemplative animal. I mean that in a positive way, so let me just unpack that a bit further. For while we humans share with animals the five senses, humans have a reflexive capacity, a reflective consciousness. So it's a bit like saying, while with the animals we can know through our senses, only we humans can know that we know. What I'd like to do is conclude with this little statement. There's an Indigenous woman called Miriam Rose. You may know of her. She lives in the Dali River. And she uses the word dadiri. And perhaps dadiri is another way of talking about discernment. She says dadiri is its inner, its deep listening and quiet, still awareness. So what I'd like to do is I'm just going to read this first, and then to conclude, I invite you to read that with me. So I'll read this first. To know me is to breathe with me. To breathe with me is to listen deeply. To listen deeply is to connect. It's the sound of deep calling to deep, dadiri, the deep inner spring within us. We call on it and it calls on us. So I invite you to join me. To know me is to breathe with me. To breathe with me is to listen deeply. To listen deeply is to connect. It's the sound of deep calling to deep, dadiri, the deep inner spring within us. We call on it and it calls on us. Thanks very much. Now, how are we going for time? Questions or comments? Yeah. Or overwhelmed by contemplative awareness? Or so?
Maybe we can do that over a couple.
Yeah, because I think I've gone over time. Very good. That's very good.